Chapter 1. The History of Psychonautics, Ancient, Aboriginal, and Modern Technologies of the Sacred, Part 1.
Before we start exploring specific topics in this encyclopedia, I would like to clarify some terms that I will be using throughout this work. I will be drawing on 60 years of my observations and experiences in the research of a large and important subgroup of non-ordinary states of consciousness that have remarkable healing, transformative, evolutionary, and heuristic potential. Modern psychiatry has no specific name for these states and sees all of them as pathological distortions, altered states. Holotropic states of consciousness. Early in my professional career, I realized the great positive potential of these states and the urgent need to correct this error. I decided to coin the term holotropic, meaning moving toward wholeness, from the Greek holos, meaning whole, and trepo, trepein, meaning moving toward or being attracted by something. The word holotropic is a neologism, but it is related to the commonly used term heliotropism, the property of plants to always move in the direction of the sun. The term commonly used by mainstream clinicians and theoreticians, altered states of consciousness, is not appropriate because of its one-sided emphasis on the distortion or impairment of the correct way of experiencing oneself and the world. In colloquial English and veterinary jargon, the term alter is also used to signify castration of domestic animals. The somewhat better term non-ordinary states of consciousness is too broad and general, since it includes a wide range of conditions that do not have the beneficial properties of holotropic states. This includes trivial deliria caused by infectious diseases, the abuse of alcohol, or circulatory and degenerative diseases of the brain. These alterations of consciousness are associated with disorientation, impairment of intellectual functions, and subsequent amnesia. They're clinically important, but lack therapeutic and heuristic potential. By comparison, the states which I call holotropic have great theoretical and practical importance. These are the states that novice shamans experience during their initiatory crises and later induce in their clients for therapeutic purposes. Ancient and native cultures have used these states in rites of passage and in their healing ceremonies. The experiences of initiates in the ancient mysteries of death and rebirth, as well as those described by mystics of all ages and from many countries, are also holotropic experiences. Procedures inducing these states, technologies of the sacred, were developed and used in the context of the great religions of the world: Hinduism, Buddhism, Jainism, Taoism, Islam, Judaism, and Christianity. They involve meditation, movement meditation, breathing exercises, prayers, fasting, sleep deprivation, and even the use of physical pain. The most powerful means for inducing holotropic experiences are psychedelic plants, the pure, active alkaloids extracted from them, and synthetic entheogens. There are also powerful forms of experiential psychotherapy, such as rebirthing, holotropic breathwork, and others that can induce these states without the use of psychedelic medicines. The name holotropic suggests something that might come as a surprise to the average Westerner, that in our everyday state of consciousness, we use only a small fraction of our perceptual and experiential potential and are not aware of the full extent of our being. Holotropic states of consciousness have the potential to help us to use the terms of the British-American philosopher and writer Alan Watts, to break the taboo against knowing who we are and realize that we are not skin-encapsulated egos, and that, in the last analysis, we are commensurate with the cosmic creative principle itself. Pierre Teilhard de Chardin, the French paleontologist, Jesuit, and philosopher, expressed it differently. We are not human beings having spiritual experiences. We are spiritual beings having a human experience. This astonishing idea is not new. In the ancient Indian Chandogya Upanishad, the answer to the question, "Who am I?" is Tat Tvam Asi. This succinct Sanskrit sentence means literally, "Thou art that," or "You are Godhead." It suggests that we are not Namarupa, name and form, body, ego, but that our deepest identity is that of a divine spark of cosmic creative energy that we carry in our innermost being, Atman, which is ultimately identical with the supreme universal principle that creates the universe, Brahman. For the Hindus, this is not a belief or unsubstantiated conviction, but something that can be experientially validated if we follow certain rigorous spiritual practices and various forms of yoga. Hinduism is not the only religion that has made this discovery. The revelation concerning the identity of the individual with the divine is the ultimate secret that lies at the mystical core of all great spiritual traditions. Therefore, the name for this principle could be the Tao, the Buddha, Shiva of Kashmir Shaivism, Cosmic Christ, Pleroma, Allah, and many others. This can be seen in quotes from various religions. We have already seen that the Hindus believe in the essential identity of Atman with Brahman, and that the Upanishads reveal our divine nature in their Tat Tvam Asi. Swami Muktananda, the head of the Siddha Yoga tradition, used to say, "God dwells in you as you." In the Buddhist scriptures, we can read, "Look inside. You are the Buddha." The intention during Buddhist practice is not to attain something or become something other than what we are, but realize who we are already. In mystical Christianity, Jesus tells his followers, "Father, you and I are one." And the divine kingdom does not come by expectation. The divine kingdom is here, and people do not see it. According to St. Gregory Palamas, the kingdom of heaven, nay, the king of heaven, is within us. Kabbalist Avraham ben Shemuel Abulafia proclaimed, "He and we are one." In the Confucian texts, we read, "Heaven, earth, and humans are the same." According to Muhammad, "Whoever knows himself knows his Lord." And the Persian poet, Sufi Mansur al-Halaj, who had realized his own divinity and had the courage to declare it publicly, "Anal Haq, I am God, the absolute truth," had to pay a great price. He was killed, and his body was burned. Holotropic experiences have the potential to help us discover our true identity and our cosmic status. They also provide deep insights into the nature of reality, far beyond what is available in the everyday state of consciousness. Sometimes this happens in small increments, other times in the form of major breakthroughs. Psychonautics can be defined as the systematic pursuit and use of holotropic states of consciousness for healing, self-exploration, ritual activity, artistic inspiration, and as a spiritual, philosophical, and scientific quest. It is a response to a deep craving for transcendental experiences that Andrew Weil described in his book, The Natural Mind, as the deepest drive in the human psyche, more powerful than sex. Psychonauts of the Paleolithic Era. The practice of inducing holotropic states of consciousness can be traced back to the dawn of human history. It is the most important characteristic feature of shamanism, the oldest spiritual system and healing art of humanity. Shamanism is extremely ancient, probably at least 30 to 40,000 years old. Its roots can be found as far back as the Paleolithic era. The walls of the famous caves in southern France and northern Spain, such as Lascaux, Font de Gaume, Les Trois Frères, Altamira, and others, are decorated with beautiful images of animals. Most of them represent species that actually roamed the Stone Age landscape. Bisons, aurochs, wild horses, stags, ibexes, mammoths, wolves, rhinos, and reindeer. However, others are mythical creatures that clearly have magical and ritual significance, such as the mythic beast from the Lascaux cave with long parallel horns, a double unicorn, protruding from his front that resemble the masks of the Australian Aborigines. Several of these caves have paintings and carvings of strange figures that combine human and animal features, which undoubtedly represent ancient shamans. The best known of these images is the sorcerer of Les Trois Frères, a mysterious composite figure combining various male symbols. He has the antlers of a stag, eyes of an owl, tail of a wild horse or wolf, human beard, and paws of a lion. Another famous carving of a shaman in the same cave complex is the Beastmaster, presiding over the happy hunting grounds teeming with beautiful animals. Also well known is the hunting scene on the wall in Lascaux. It shows an eviscerated bison pierced with a spear and a figure lying on the ground. It was originally interpreted as a hunting accident until it was noticed that the figure has an erect penis, an unlikely occurrence in a wounded or dying person, but a very common sign of a shamanic trance. The grotto known as La Gabillou harbors a carving of a shamanic figure in dynamic movement whom the archaeologists call the Dancer. On the clay floor of one of these caves, Touc du Duber, the discoverers found footprints in a circular arrangement around two clay bison effigies, suggesting that its inhabitants performed dances similar to those that are still being conducted by many Aboriginal cultures for the induction of trance states. The origins of shamanism can be traced back to an even older group, a Neanderthal cult of the cave bear, as exemplified by the animal shrines from the interglacial period found in grottos in the Swiss region of Engadin and southern Germany. It must have been extremely hard to carve and paint these images in the inaccessible depths of these caves, using only primitive torches and standing, in some instances, on small knolls high on the walls. It would have been much easier to portray animals, depict scenes of the hunt, or use images for hunting magic on the surface of the earth. There clearly had to be a special reason to undergo such challenges. Rock art scholar David Lewis Williams suggested in his book, The Mind in the Cave, that the artists in these caves were ancient shamans who were experiencing trance states and portraying their visions. Mythologist Joseph Campbell proposed that these caves with long, narrow passages leading into them were places for rituals celebrating the great mother goddess, and that they represented her genitals and belly. He also thought that the ancient Venus figures and figurines celebrating female fertility, such as Venus of Willendorf, Venus of Dolny Vestonice, or Venus of Locelle, were related to the same cult of the great mother goddess. Shamanism is not only ancient, it is also global. It can be found in North, Central, and South America, in Europe, Africa, Asia, Australia, Micronesia, and Polynesia. The fact that so many different cultures throughout human history have found shamanic techniques useful and relevant suggests that the holotropic states engage what the anthropologists call the primal mind, a basic and primordial aspect of the human psyche that transcends race, gender, culture, and historical period. In cultures that have escaped the disruptive influence of Western industrial civilization, shamanic techniques and procedures have survived to this day. The career, for many shamans, begins with a spontaneous, psycho-spiritual crisis, shamanic illness. It is a powerful visionary state during which the future shaman experiences a journey into the underworld, or the realm of the dead, where he or she is attacked by evil spirits, subjected to various ordeals, killed, and dismembered. This is followed by an experience of rebirth and an ascent into the celestial realms. Shamanism is also connected with holotropic states, in that accomplished and experienced shamans are able to enter into a trance state at will and in a controlled manner. They use it for diagnosing and healing when the client, the healer, or both of them are in a holotropic state at the same time. The shamans play the role of psychopomps for holotropic states of other members of their tribes. They provide the necessary support and guidance for traversing the complex territories of the beyond. Native spirituality and rites of passage. Native tribes of many different countries and time periods have spent a lot of time and effort developing methods to induce holotropic experiences or technologies of the sacred. This often includes a combination of drumming, rattling, and other forms of percussion, music, chanting, rhythmic dancing, changes of breathing, and social and sensory isolation, such as staying in a cave, the desert, Arctic ice, or in high mountains. The natives also frequently use extreme physiological interventions, including fasting, sleep deprivation, dehydration, circumcision, sub-incision, the use of powerful laxatives and purgatives, and even massive bloodletting and infliction of severe pain. Native cultures use holotropic states for a variety of purposes: direct experiential contact with the archetypal dimensions of reality, deities, mythological realms, and numinous forces of nature, the healing of individuals and groups, or even an entire tribe, as exemplified by the Bushmen in the African Kalahari Desert, artistic inspiration, ideas for rituals, paintings, sculptures, and songs, and the cultivation of intuition and extrasensory perception, finding lost persons and objects, obtaining information about people in remote locations, and following the movement of the game they hunt. Another important reason for inducing holotropic states is to expand the consciousness of participants in the ritual events of native cultures, which the Dutch anthropologist Arnold van Gennep calls rites of passage. Ceremonies of this kind existed in all known native cultures and are still being performed in many pre-industrial societies. Their main purpose is to redefine, transform, and consecrate individuals, groups, and even entire cultures. Rites of passage are conducted at times of important biological or social transitions, such as childbirth, circumcision, puberty, marriage, menopause, and before death. Similar rituals are also associated with initiation into warrior status, acceptance into secret societies, calendrical festivals of renewal, healing ceremonies, and geographical movement of human groups. Rites of passage involve powerful consciousness-expanding procedures that induce psychologically disorganizing experiences, resulting in a higher level of integration. This episode of psycho-spiritual death and rebirth is then interpreted as dying in the old role and being born into the new one. For example, in the puberty rites, the initiates enter the procedure as boys or girls and emerge as adults with all the rights and duties that come with this status. In all these situations, the individual or social group leaves behind one mode of being and moves into totally new life circumstances. The person who returns from the initiation is not the same as the one who entered the initiation process. Having undergone a deep psycho-spiritual transformation, he or she has a personal connection with the numinous dimensions of existence, as well as a new and greatly expanded worldview, a better self-image, more self-confidence, and a different system of values. All of this is the result of a deliberately induced crisis that reaches the very core of the initiate's being and is at times terrifying, chaotic, and disorienting. For some time, the initiate can be in a confusing state that the anthropologists refer to as betwixt and between, having lost their old identity and not yet attained the new one. The rites of passage thus provide another example of a situation in which a period of temporary disintegration and turmoil leads to greater sanity and well-being. Polish psychiatrist Kazimierz Dąbrowski observed this process occurring spontaneously in his patients and coined for it the term positive disintegration. The two examples of positive disintegration we have discussed so far, the shamanic initiatory crisis and the experience of the rite of passage, have many features in common, but they also differ in some important respects. The shamanic crisis invades the psyche of the future shaman unexpectedly and without warning. It is spontaneous and autonomous in nature. By comparison, the rites of passage are a product of the culture and follow a predictable time schedule. The experiences of the initiates are the result of specific technologies of the sacred, developed and perfected by previous generations. In cultures that venerate shamans and also conduct rites of passage, the shamanic crisis is considered to be a form of initiation that is much superior to the rite of passage. It is seen as the intervention of a higher power, and thus an indication of divine choice and a special calling. From another perspective, rites of passage represent a further step in cultural appreciation of the positive value of holotropic states of consciousness. Shamanic cultures accept and hold in high esteem both holotropic states that occur spontaneously during initiatory crises and the healing trance experienced or induced by recognized shamans. Rites of passage introduce holotropic states into the culture on a large scale, institutionalize them, and make them an integral part of ritual and spiritual life. Ancient mysteries of death and rebirth. Holotropic states also played a critical role in the ancient mysteries of death and rebirth, sacred and secret procedures that were widespread all over the ancient world. These mysteries were based on mythological stories about deities who symbolized death and transfiguration. In ancient Sumer, it was Inanna and Dumuzi. In Egypt, Isis and Osiris. In Greece, the deities Attis, Adonis, Dionysus, and Persephone. And in Italy, the Iranian Roman Mithra. Their Mesoamerican counterparts were the Aztec Quetzalcoatl, or the plumed serpent, and the Mayan hero twins, as depicted in the Popol Vuh. These mysteries were particularly popular in the Mediterranean area and in the Middle East, as exemplified by the Sumerian and Egyptian temple initiations. The Mithraic mysteries, as well as the Greek Chorobantic rites, Bacchanalia, and the mysteries of Eleusis. The key to the powerful transformation that the initiates experienced in the course of the Eleusinian mysteries was the sacred potion Kaikion, capable of inducing visions of the afterlife so powerful that it changed the way participants saw the world and their place in it. They were freed from the fear of death through the recognition that they were immortal souls, temporarily in mortal bodies. An impressive testimony for the power and impact of what transpired in these events is the fact that the mysteries conducted in the Eleusinian sanctuary near Athens took place regularly and without interruption every 5 years for a period of almost 2,000 years. They were observed regularly from circa 1600 BC until 392 AD. Even then, they did not simply cease to attract the attention of the antique world. The ceremonial activities in Eleusis were brutally interrupted when the Christian emperor Theodosius interdicted participation in the mysteries and all other pagan cults. Shortly afterward, in 395 AD, the invading Goths destroyed the sanctuary. In the Telestrion, the giant initiation hall in Eleusis, more than 3,000 neophytes at a time experienced powerful experiences of psycho-spiritual transformation. The cultural importance of these mysteries for the ancient world and their as-yet unacknowledged role in the history of European civilization becomes evident when we recognize that there were many famous and illustrious figures of antiquity among the initiates. The list of neophytes included the philosophers Plato, Aristotle, and Epictetus, the military leader Alcibiades, the playwrights Euripides and Sophocles, and the poet Pindar. Another famous initiate, Emperor Marcus Aurelius, was fascinated by the eschatological hopes offered by these rites. The Roman statesman and philosopher Marcus Tullius Cicero took part in these mysteries and wrote an exalted report about their effects on Greek and Roman civilization. In De Legibus, about laws, Cicero wrote, "For among the many excellent and indeed divine institutions which your Athens has brought forth and contributed to human life, none, in my opinion, is better than those mysteries. For by their means we have been brought out of our barbarous and savage mode of life, and educated and refined to a state of civilization, and as the rites are called initiations, so in very truth we have learned from them the beginnings of life, and have gained the power not only to live happily, but also to die with a better hope." Mithraism is another example of the great respect and influence the ancient mystery religions had in the antique world. It began to spread throughout the Roman Empire in the 1st century AD, reached its peak in the 3rd century, and succumbed to Christianity at the end of the 4th century. At the cult's height, the underground Mithraic sanctuaries, Mithraea, could be found from the shores of the Black Sea to the mountains of Scotland to the borders of the Sahara Desert. The Mithraic mysteries represented the sister religion of Christianity and its most important competitor. The specifics of the consciousness-expanding procedures involved in these secret rites have remained for the most part unknown, although three respectable scientists, mycologist Gordon Wasson, discoverer of LSD-25 Albert Hofmann, and Greek scholar Karl Ruck, collected impressive evidence that the sacred potion Kaikion used in the Eleusinian mysteries was a concoction containing alkaloids of ergot, similar to LSD. They described their meticulous research in the book The Road to Eleusis, unveiling the secret of the mysteries. It is also highly probable that psychedelic materials were also involved in the bacchanalia and other types of rites. Ancient Greeks did not know distillation of alcohol and could not ferment drinks with a higher concentration than 14%, which stops the fermentation process. But, according to the reports, the wines used in Dionysian rituals had to be diluted 3 to 20 times, and just 3 cups of it brought some initiates to the brink of insanity. Spiritual practices of the great religions. In addition to the ancient and aboriginal technologies of the sacred mentioned earlier, many great religions developed sophisticated psychospiritual procedures specifically designed to induce holotropic experiences. This includes, for example, different systems of yoga, meditations and movement meditations used in Vipassana, Zen, and Tibetan Buddhism, and spiritual exercises of the Taoist traditions, along with complex tantric rituals. I should also mention various elaborate approaches used by the Sufis, the mystics of Islam. They regularly used intense breathing, devotional chants, and a trance-inducing whirling dance in their sacred ceremonies, or dhikrs. From the Judeo-Christian tradition, we can mention the breathing exercises of the Essenes and their baptism, which involved half-drowning. Included in this list are the Jesus Prayer, Hesychasm, the exercises of Ignatius of Loyola, and Hasidic dances, as well as Kabbalistic meditations, which use letters of the Hebrew alphabet, reciting the name of God, breathing, and music. Approaches designed to induce or facilitate direct spiritual experiences are characteristic of the mystical branches of the great religions, their monastic orders, and fringe sects like the Pentecostals and snake handlers or holy ghost people. Ritual use of psychedelic medicines. The most powerful means of inducing holotropic states of consciousness are psychedelic plants and substances, and the history of their ritual use can be traced back thousands of years. In the Rig Veda, more than 100 stanzas are dedicated to the plant and sacred potion called Soma. The 9th mandala of the Rig Veda, known as the Soma Mandala, consists entirely of hymns addressed to Soma Pavamana, purified Soma. The power of Soma is evident from statements describing its effect, such as, "Half of us is on earth, and the other half in heaven. We have drunk Soma." Or, "We have drunk Soma and become immortal. We have attained the light, the gods discovered." In the Zoroastrian Zend Avesta, The same sacred drink is known as hauma. The first historical record about the healing power of cannabis can be found in the writings of the Chinese emperor Shen Ning from the year 2737 BC. Different varieties of hemp have been smoked and ingested under various names: hashish, charas, bhang, ganja, keef, marijuana. In India, the Middle East, Africa, and the Caribbean area, for recreation, pleasure, and during religious ceremonies. They have represented an important sacrament for such diverse groups as the Brahmins, certain Sufi orders, ancient Scythians, and the Jamaican Rastafarians. According to some controversial theories, psychedelics might have played an important role in Judeo-Christian history. Dan Merker suggested in his book The Mystery of Manna, the psychedelic sacrament of the Bible, that manna was a psychedelic substance. Dead Sea Scrolls scholar John Allegro argued in his book The Sacred Mushroom and the Cross that Christianity started as a shamanic cult using the fly agaric mushroom, Amanita muscaria, as a sacrament. John Lash Lamb found numerous depictions of stylized mushrooms in the Paris Edwin Psalter. Mike Crowley concluded in his well-documented book, Secret Drugs of Buddhism, Psychedelic Sacraments and the Origins of the Vajrayana, that consciousness-expanding substances played an important role in Tibetan Buddhism. Drawing on sacred scriptures, iconography, botany, and pharmacology, Crowley amassed impressive evidence that psychedelic substances from Soma to Amrita deeply influenced the development of Indian religions. He suggested that Cintamani, the wish-fulfillment gem, might have been a mushroom related to the genus Psilocybe, and that trees associated with the goddess Tara, such as the acacia, might have been used to produce drinks containing DMT, which is similar to ayahuasca, Indohuasca. Mycologist Gordon Wasson carried out meticulous research concerning the meal that, according to the Mahaparinibbana Sutra, the metal worker Kunda prepared for Buddha before Buddha entered Parinirvana. There are scriptural differences about the meaning of the word Sukara Matava, the name of the food that Buddha ate. The literal translation of this word is swine bits, from Sukara, meaning pig, and Matava, meaning tender or delicate. Theravada Buddhists believe that what the Buddha ate was pork, while the Mahayana Buddhists believe that this name refers to some sort of truffle or another kind of mushroom, something that pigs or boars like to eat. Gordon Wasson concluded that the term swine bits likely referred to an entheogenic mushroom. Ceremonial use of various psychedelic materials also has a long history in Central America. Highly effective, consciousness-expanding plants were well known in several pre-Hispanic cultures, including the Aztecs, Mayans, and Toltecs. The most famous of these plants are the Mexican cactus peyote, Lafafora williamsi, the sacred mushroom Teonanacatl, Psilocybe mexicana, and Ololiuki, which are seeds of different varieties of the morning glory plant. Ipomoea violacea and Turbina corymbosa. These materials are still used as sacraments by the Huichol, Mazatec, Chichimeca, Cora, and other Mexican tribes, as well as the Native American church. The famous Aztec sculpture of Xochipitli, Lord of Flowers, God of Flowers, Maize, Beauty, Song, and Dance, which was excavated in the foothills of Popocatépetl and exhibited in the National Archaeological Museum in Mexico City, is richly decorated with carvings of floral designs. Harvard ethnobotanist Richard Schultz identified all but one as representing psychedelic plants: tendrils of morning glory, Rivea corymbosa, Psilocybe cerulea azticorum, Nicotiana tabacum, and Hymea solicifolia. He concluded that the posture of the head and body and the flexion of the toes indicate that the sculpture portrays the deity in an entheogenic ecstatic trance. Powerful consciousness-expanding procedures played an important role in the ancient Mayan culture. Many reliefs on stone stelae, sculptures, and paintings on funeral ceramics show the Mayans also used, besides peyote, magic mushrooms, and diviner sage, Salvia divinatorum, the secretions of the skin and parotid glands of the toad, Bufo marinus. A specifically Mayan mind-altering technique was massive bloodletting caused by piercing the tongues, earlobes, and genitals by lancets made of stingray spines, flint, or obsidian. The famous South American yaje, or ayahuasca, which has been used for centuries by various Amazonian tribes for healing and initiation rituals, is a decoction from a jungle liana, Banisteriopsis capi, combined with other plant additives, Psychotria viridis, and others. Ayahuasca is legal in Brazil and is being used by individual ayahuasqueros. In group sessions of the União de Vegetal, a religious society that seeks to promote peace and to work for spiritual development of the human beings, and by the Santo Daime, a syncretistic religious movement with a similar mission. The origins of the use of ayahuasca are shrouded in great mystery. This sacred potion is a jungle brew that requires a combination of two different plants that make perfect chemical sense. Psychotria and some other additives used in the preparation of ayahuasca contain psychoactive tryptamines, and the Banisteriopsis liana contributes a monoamino oxidase, MAO, inhibitor that protects monoamines from fast degradation in the gastrointestinal tract. It is easy to imagine that a hungry person finds a mushroom in the woods and, by tasting it, discovers its psychedelic property. It is less likely, but still conceivable, that somebody tries to eat a peyote cactus in spite of its prohibitive taste. However, the probability of accidentally discovering, among thousands of Amazonian plants, two that ideally complement each other's chemical effects to produce a psychedelic potion seems astronomically low. In addition, the fact that the hard, woody liana requires many hours of cooking to extract the alkaloid makes the accidental discovery of this procedure close to impossible. The natives claim that the plants themselves told them how they should be used. In recent decades, the Santo Daime people and the União de Vegetal have been introducing the ritual use of ayahuasca to industrial civilization in an effort to counteract alienation, loss of spirituality, and the ecological degradation of our planet. The Amazonian area and the Caribbean islands are also known for a variety of psychedelic snuffs. Aboriginal tribes in Africa ingest and inhale preparations from the bark of the iboga shrub, Tabernanthe iboga. They use them in small quantities as stimulants during lion hunts and long canoe trips, and in larger doses for initiation rituals for men and women. Scientific interest in psychedelic plants. Compared to the millennia of human use of psychedelic plants and compounds as sacraments and sacred medicines, the period of scientific interest in them has been relatively short. The era of scientific research of psychedelics began at the turn of the 20th century by the isolation of mescaline, the active principle of peyote, by Arthur Hefter. This was followed by 3 decades of experiments with this substance, culminating in the publication of the book Mescaline Rausch by Kurt Behringer. It is surprising that during this period of experimentation, researchers did not discover and describe mescaline's therapeutic potential and its capacity to induce mystical experiences. They concluded that this substance caused toxic psychosis and focused primarily on the remarkable effects that it had on sensory perception and artistic creativity. The active alkaloid from Tabernanthe iboga was isolated in 1901 by Dybowski and Landrin and called ibogaine. From the 1930s to 1960s, ibogaine was sold in France in the form of lambarine, an extract of the plant Tabernanthe manii, and promoted as a mental and physical stimulant. It was withdrawn from the market in 1966. Active alkaloids have also been isolated from Paganum harmala, Banisteria caapi, and harmaline, also called benisterine, hagine, telepathine. The active principles in the secretions of Bufo alvarius were identified as tryptamine derivatives, dimethyltryptamine, DMT, and 5-methoxy-DMT. The psychedelic properties of bufotenine, 5-hydroxy-DMT, remained uncertain. The same tryptamines also turned out to be the active principles of the Caribbean psychedelic snuffs. Albert Hofmann and the Golden Era of Psychonautics. The Golden Era of Psychonautics began with Albert Hofmann's synthesis of the ergot alkaloid LSD-25 and his discovery of its psychedelic effects. This discovery is usually described as accidental, but it was more complicated than that. Albert Hofmann himself preferred to call it serendipitous. This word comes from an old Persian fairy tale, Three Princes of Serendip, Sri Lanka. A story of 3 brothers who travel together and discover, through accidents and sagacity, the nature of a lost camel. They are able to deduce from subtle environmental cues that a camel who walked on the road before them had had only 1 eye, was missing a tooth, was lame, and carried a pregnant woman, with honey on his one side and butter on the other. Albert Hofmann synthesized LSD-25 for the first time in 1938 as the 25th substance in a series of derivatives of lysergic acid, an essential component of ergot alkaloids. The name of this acid reflects the fact that it was created by dissolution, Greek, lysis, of ergot. The ergot compounds are used in medicine to stop gynecological bleeding, relieve migraine headaches, and improve blood circulation in the brains of geriatric patients. The psychedelic LSD-25 is thus an apple that fell far from the tree. Following the routine protocol, Albert sent the sample to the pharmacological department for testing. The report that came back from the laboratory was very discouraging. It described LSD-25 as a substance that was not particularly interesting and did not deserve further research. In the following years, Albert continued to synthesize various other derivatives of lysergic acid, but he somehow could not get LSD-25 off his mind. He could not get rid of a pervasive feeling that, with this particular substance, the researchers in the laboratory must have overlooked something. He reviewed the laboratory report and discovered that some of the mice showed psychomotor agitation after the administration of LSD-25. He came to the conclusion that because of its structural similarity with nicotinamide, a central nervous system stimulant, it might be interesting to test it as a potential analeptic. Finally, in 1943, this feeling became so strong that he decided to synthesize another sample of LSD and have it tested. No matter how sophisticated these new tests would have been, experiments with animals would not have been able to reveal that it had psychedelic effects. And this is where the remarkable accident came in. As Albert was working on his synthesis, he started feeling strange. He was experiencing strong waves of emotions, seeing strange colors, and his perception of his surrounding environment was profoundly affected. He was initially afraid that he was having a psychotic episode, and when 2.5 hours later he returned to normal, he came to the conclusion that he might have accidentally intoxicated himself by the substance he was working with. 3 days later, he decided to test this idea with an auto experiment. He prepared his work for the day and took a measured dose of LSD-25. Being very conservative, as he described himself, he took what he considered to be a minuscule dose of 250 micrograms, millions of a gram, or gamma. Only 25% of the dose commonly used with other ergot alkaloids. He naturally could not have known the enormous psychoactive power of the substance he had created. Later, when we were using LSD-25 therapeutically, 250 micrograms was considered a dose that required several hours of preparation, a special environment, and preferably two sitters, one male and the other female, supervising the affected person for 6 to 8 hours. We kept these clients overnight in the institute and talked with them in the morning before they went home. Albert took this dose casually, expecting that he would work as usual and close his eyes every half an hour to find out if anything was happening. Within 45 minutes, the substance started having an effect. This time, it was incomparably stronger. Albert had to stop working and asked his assistant to take him home. But it was wartime, and there were restrictions on the use of cars, so many people in Basel used bicycles to get around. Albert's description of his ride through the streets of Basel has become legendary. It seemed to him that it would never stop. When they finally arrived home, Albert was in a very bad condition. He suspected his neighbor was a witch and was hexing and killing him. He thought he was dying, and he asked his assistant to call a doctor. By the time the doctor arrived, though, the situation had changed. Albert had relived his birth and felt wonderful, like a newborn. He wrote a report about this extraordinary experiment to his boss, Dr. Walter Stoll. It just happened that Dr. Stoll's son, Werner, was a psychiatrist and agreed to conduct a pilot study with this fascinating new substance. He administered LSD-25 to a group of normal subjects and a group of patients with psychiatric diagnoses. In 1947, he published a paper on this study entitled LSD-25, a Fantasticum from the Ergot Group. After the publication of this study, this new semi-synthetic ergot derivative practically became an overnight sensation in the world of science. It is not generally known that it was not the psychedelic effect of LSD that caused the sensation. Anthropologists and historians had known for a long time that many ancient and native cultures used plants with psychedelic effects in their ritual and spiritual life, and for healing. By the time of Albert's discovery, chemists had already isolated the active principles from some of these plants. It was the incredible intensity of the effects of LSD-25 that was sensational. It is effective in minute quantities, millionths of a gram, micrograms, or gammas. Just for comparison, we need about 100 milligrams of mescaline for a good session. Approximately the same intensity can be achieved with 100 micrograms of LSD-25, about 1,000th of that dose. It was therefore conceivable that the human body could produce a similar substance, toxin X, and that serious mental diseases or psychoses would actually be chemical aberrations that could be treated by an appropriate antidote, a substance that would neutralize its effects. This would have been a test tube solution for schizophrenia, the holy grail of psychiatry. In the early stages of LSD research, psychedelics were referred to as hallucinogens, psychotomimetic substances, and even delirogens, and the states induced by them as experimental psychoses. It took psychotherapeutically oriented clinicians to overcome this preconception. The discovery of LSD and the hunt for toxin X started what has been called a golden era of psychopharmacology. During a relatively short period of time, the joint efforts of biochemists, pharmacologists, neurophysiologists, psychiatrists, and psychologists succeeded in laying the foundations of a new scientific discipline that can be referred to as the pharmacology of consciousness. The active substances from several remaining psychedelic plants were chemically identified and prepared in chemically pure forms. A particularly important and exciting chapter of the history of psychonautics was in solving the mystery of the effects of the magic mushrooms of the Mazatecs, indigenous people of the Mexican state Oaxaca.